Hi, I'm Jenny.
And I'm Shelby.
And this is Chub Rub Book Club.
Hello, Jenny.
Hi, Shelby.
Are you ready for our intro question for this week?
You know that I am.
Okay, so this question is partly brought on by my, like, book reading insomnia, which is not real insomnia. It's just that whole, like, you know, stay up too late reading a book by accident kind of sleeplessness. And okay, so I was reminded of a book that I love from my childhood that kept me up. And so it made me want to ask this question. What book or books from your childhood were, like, really impactful? Like, what did you love? What did you love to read when you were a kid?
Wow, what a great question. The first thing that comes to mind is A Series of Unfortunate Events by Lemony Snicket.
Oh, yes. 100% yes.
Such a, honestly, formative. So in case you're not familiar, it is a book series of 13 books. And, like, the later ones are not that short. Like,
they're really not.
And it follows a family that has increasingly unfortunate things happen to them. Three children who have lost their parents, and, like, there's this grand conspiracy, and it was the first thing I'd ever read that was, like, dark and funny at the same time, which is, like, a combination that I still kind of enjoy, like, finding the humor in things that are scary and difficult, and not making them less, but seeing how ridiculous the world is sometimes. And it was one of the very first books I ever read that, like, had really, that really taught me that adults don't have the answers to things a lot of the time. I think I was a pretty idealistic child, and I believed that the grownups knew the right thing to do and would do the right thing. And reading those books, like, again and again, well-meaning adults completely fail to help, and ill-meaning adults enact their ill will on the characters.
Yeah.
Which, like, reflecting back now, I'm like, gosh, that was a lot. But I think it was sort of the first time I realized as a young person that there was injustice in the world that wasn't, like, there was injustice in the world because of quote unquote bad people, but there was also injustice in the world because quote unquote good people let it happen. So, I mean, they're super good books, but I remember when I was probably 11 trying to write a letter to Lemony Snicket demanding he answer my questions. And because I had so many of them, I was like, what is in the sugar bowl?
Very on brand.
And I don't think I ever sent that letter, but I was very like, dear Mr. Snicket, I have 11 questions.
Amazing. Anyway,
what about you?
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, before I answer, I just want to mention, in the last episode, we talked about book to film adaptations, and A Series of Unfortunate Events has been adapted to be a Netflix series, right?
There was a movie first that was very bad. And then there was a Netflix series. And the Netflix series, I haven't seen all of it, but what I have seen was pretty good.
Okay. I haven't watched either because I felt like there was just no way that it could live up to the expectation in my head. Like, I haven't read those books since childhood, you know? Like, unlike Harry Potter, which I reread every year, A Series of Unfortunate Events, I haven't read since I was a kid. And I was like, I feel like it would be spoiled.
The Netflix series is good. It gets it. I would say take a gander.
All right. I'll put it on my list. But okay, so to answer the question for myself, the book that made me think of this is Bridge to Terabithia. Oh my.
Another book with a movie adaptation.
Yes, which, okay, I have to say, I think Anna Sophia Robb and Josh Hutcherson, like, they did a good job. Was it the same as the book? No. Did it live up to my expectations? No. But honestly, like, how could it have? I mean, I think that book inspired such imagination. I adored it. I adored that book. I remember sitting, and there were some parts that were like a little bit scary to me when I read it. I was pretty young. And so I actually snuck into my parents' room at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and they were asleep. And I sat at the foot of their bed with a flashlight, and I read the book, the entirety of the book, in the dark at the foot of my parents' bed until I finished it.
That's amazing.
So even as a child, I was definitely one of those like flashlight up late reading kids.
Mm-hmm.
But even before Bridge to Terabithia, I really loved, I think it's called like the Magic Treehouse series.
Oh yes. Uh-huh.
Annie and her brother, Jack. Whose name I won't remember. Jack. Yes. And their dog and all of their adventures. Though I think those are the books that actually like really taught me to love reading. I was behind in reading when I was in first grade.
Hmm.
And by the end of second grade, I was at the top of my class. Wow. And it was thanks to those books. I would go to the library, and I think you had a limit. You could check out like 2 books at a time or something of the school library. And so I would check out 2 Magic Treehouse books. And I would read one during the day, and I would read one at home that night. And then I would come back the next day and I would do it again until I'd read all of them. And then I started over.
I did a very similar thing. I remember doing that. I don't remember a lot of the books that I read, but I read a lot of books that way, checking out one every day, reading it all that afternoon and night, bringing it back the next morning. Yeah, you just inspired me to think of so many different things, but the most germane, I would say, is that, and this might be a friendship ruiner. I don't like Bridge to Terabithia.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Oh no. Wait, how did this not come up before?
Like, how has we've 100% this never come
talked
up?
About yeah. Bridge to Terabithia before.
No, we haven't.
Yes, we have, because remember that one time that we played D&D and I based my character off of like imaginings from Bridge to Terabithia, because that was like my favorite book as a kid.
Well, okay, then we had not reached the 5-year point of our friendship where I felt comfortable telling you that I don't like Bridge to Terabithia.
You don't like it. Okay, what is it? What is it that you don't like?
Okay, so I had a very low tolerance for, you might call it like dreaminess, like manic pixie dream girlishness, mm-hmm. as a child. I couldn't tell you why, but I had, when I was in fourth grade, I read Anne of Green Gables and I hated it.
I loved Anne of Green Gables.
And I think, but no, listen, I think it's because she had this like head in the clouds, idealistic, like, pissed me off as a kid. I don't know if it was like repressed anger or what, but like I did not like it. And I don't remember the girl's name in Bridge to Terabithia, but
I honestly don't either.
You remind me? Okay. But she had that same quality and it drove me up a wall. Like, I did not care. And I felt no feelings about it, except like I didn't like it. So who knows? I might have liked it if I read it when I was older, but
wow.
I read it at this age where I was just like, I hate this.
Wow.
And I've never returned to it. Yeah.
That is so interesting to me because like that was who I was as a child. Like I 100% identified with that main character because I always felt like the weird girl at school. I was like kind of quiet. I really liked to read and like get lost in the magical world of books. And I had a rich imagination. But
that's the thing, so did I.
I had a rich imagination. I like loved to play make-believe stuff like in the backyard and all of that. Like I identified with her so much and the world that she was able to show this boy. And it just moved me. And so that's really interesting to me that you didn't like that. Like I identified with Anne of Green Gables too, for the same reason. She was like this sort of independent girl, right? Who had a mind of her own and a head in the clouds. And like, that's how I felt about myself.
Well, it's interesting. And this is an ongoing conversation between me and my mom is like, she loves Anne of Green Gables. And she was so excited for me to read it when I was young. And she was like, you're going to love it. You're going to see yourself in her so much. And then I read it and I hated it. So like, maybe there's some like internalized self-hatred happening there. I don't know. Excuse me. My cat has decided to give her opinion. But yeah, no, I mean, it's been fun recording this podcast, Shelby, but if you want to end it
no.
because of this revelation.
Of course not. Of course not. I will say like my heart is a little bit broken, but we'll make it through. Our friendship is strong enough to weather this storm. Okay. So the book for today.
She said her voice breaks because she's so betrayed.
Okay, so but really like I think that this is a fun book for us to discuss after having that conversation.
Yes.
Today we are reading A Curse So Dark and Lonely by Bridget Kemmerer, and it is of course a fairy tale retelling, because y'all know how we feel about fairy tale retellings.
If it hasn't become abundantly clear yet, we are quite partial to them.
And, you know, we would be remiss if we did not mention that probably the most retold of all fairy tales in YA, you know, novel format is Beauty and the Beast.
With good reason. I think Disney has a lot to blame for that. You know, bookish young people saw themselves in Belle and fell in love with Beauty and the Beast, and then saw that there were Beauty and the Beast retellings and said, yes, that one.
Exactly. It's 100% me. I'm very predictable. Belle was always my favorite, like, Disney princess growing up because she had brown hair and she liked mm-hmm. books. And that mm-hmm. was, like, all it took. That was it.
Same. Yeah.
So
where do you want to start?
Let's give a brief synopsis, because I think it's important to set these retellings apart by what makes them unique.
Okay. So there is a girl. Her name is Harper. She is in modern day Washington, D.C.,
which I loved, by the way. Very unexpected for me.
Yes. And suddenly, she tries to break up what she thinks is a guy, like, about to take advantage of a woman. And she attacks him with, like, a tire iron, I think.
So, yeah, something like that.
And in the process, he whisks her away to a magical land.
Honestly, like, you know, her nightmare, my dream.
And it turns out that he is, the person who whisked her away is named Gray, and he is a member of the Royal Guard. And he...
The only remaining member.
Yes. And he has brought her to his prince, whose name is Ren. And that it slowly becomes clear that Ren is cursed, and so is his whole castle. And the only way to break the curse is for Harper, our main girl, to fall in love with him. Or so they believe. That gets a little complicated.
It does. Yeah, can I also just say that, like, one thing that I truly hated about this book, the kidnapping aspect of it. Like, okay, you know, you look at the Disney film Beauty and the Beast, and, you know, he traps her in his castle for essentially, like, trespassing, right? Like, in place of her father. But no, Grace straight up travels to a different dimension and steals young women, some of whom do not make it back alive.
Yeah, it's a pretty bad look.
It's quite troubling. So I don't blame Harper and her reluctance in the beginning.
No, Harper is, I mean, literally every step of the way, Harper is relatable. Like, yeah, I get it. Like, and so all this is happening, the interpersonal sort of conflict, but then also there's a war brewing between Ren is the prince of a kingdom called Emberfall, and there's a war brewing between them and this other kingdom, and so they have to navigate that, and she pretends to be a princess from the faraway land of DC. Haha, get it? DC. And yeah, then things, they do happen.
They sure do. Also, Ren is, like, kind of incredibly short-sighted, in my opinion. And, you know, on the one hand, I get it, right? Like, you're caught in a curse. Like, you're in this repeating loop of your, what, it was like his 18th birthday or something. And,
something like that.
You know, and he has to, like, relive it. And he's killed everyone he loves except for Gray. And, you know, so, like, all he's trying to do is get out of this curse. I hear it. Like, I see it. I get it. Also, like, convincing your people that this land with an army that doesn't, I mean, like, the land exists, but not in the way that people think, right? Like, there is no army coming to back her up, right? Like, convincing people that they're saving Grace is something that, like, totally doesn't exist. I was like, really? That's your plan?
Okay, but to be fair, you're right. But in a land, in a time before Google Earth, you could tell me that there was an undiscovered island somewhere in the Pacific that had never seen outside humanity. And it would be weird, but I would be like, okay, sure.
Like, I mean, all right, like, we are talking about me, the human being that thought that the land of Genovia from the Princess Diaries was real until, like, graduate school, so.
Forgot about the that. The
fictional land of Genovia.
Oh, my God.
So, for the record, the fictional land of Genovia does have a website, like a tourist website.
Yeah, it's promotional materials for the Princess Diaries too.
So yeah, like, I hear what you're saying. It's just that, like, what matters less, I think, is, like, the fact that DC doesn't exist. It's that, like, they make the promise of armies that are just never gonna come, and, like, eventually people are gonna notice. And it does become a problem, but we'll get to that.
No, listen, it's not a perfect plan, but it's the plan they had.
It's the plan they had. And honestly, like, I enjoyed this book. I really did. So
I did too.
I was here for Harper being a very, like, non-traditional princess.
That comment actually brings me to, I have only a few problems with this book. One of them is the kidnapping, which is, again, not insignificant. And another one of them is like, there is this like weird undercurrent throughout. It kind of goes away after the first half, but in the first half, and I have a bunch of incidences of it highlighted on my Kindle, but like, there's this weird, like, oh, I like Harper because she's not like other girls thing that I did not enjoy. So as a brief explainer, when I was younger, was really into this idea that I was cool and different and special because I was not like other girls. I didn't wear makeup and I didn't have a boyfriend and I, wasn't high maintenance and XYZ, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought that that made me better. And what I've realized is that a lot of that is internalized misogyny. To say, like, these trappings of traditional femininity are lesser. And it also is hugely stereotyping to girls that maybe did wear makeup, did have boyfriends, were quote unquote high maintenance, whatever the hell that means, right? Like,
yeah, it's just another way to like pit women against each other, right?
Right, exactly. So there's these moments where like Harper, you know, has this closet full of dresses and she puts on pants and a shirt and like, cool, whatever. But Ren's like, all the other girls picked dresses out and loved, you know, walking around in them, but not Harper. And I'm like, okay, really? Like,
is that why we like her? Is it, is that the reason?
There were just a couple moments of that where I was like, is this Ren being kind of a misogynist? Or like, is this the author not realizing that this is problematic? Like, I don't know.
That's, yeah, good point. Good point.
It's just something
that, answer for you.
It's just also, something that particularly bugs me because I did it for so long.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. I used to think that, you know, like being one of the like the guys, girls type of thing, you know, like, oh, she's sporty, she's different. Like, yeah, that was something that was appealing to me, I think, because I felt like the traditional like femininity cool girl thing was something that I could never pull off. And so, yeah, again, like the whole pitting women against each other thing, like, okay, well, if I couldn't be popular in that way, like maybe I could just be like another one of the guys. But yeah, okay. Like, first of all, we grew up with very traditional, I say we, making an assumption that you grew up like I did, Jenny, with very traditional like gender roles in terms of like, you know, what colors we were expected to wear and what things we were kind of expected to do and how sporty girls were, you know, made different than preppy girls or, you know, whatever. So.
Yeah. I definitely got plenty of that. Yeah.
So, and for the record, I'm not particularly sporty either.
But for all of that, I do really like Harper. I think she's cool. We just talked about All the Stars and Teeth where we kind of left being like, who is Amora? What makes her tick? But this book, I'm like, I know Harper pretty well now. Like,
Which, spoiler alert, I've already read the second book and Harper is not one of the like point of view characters. And it really threw me off at first because I was like, wait, you're telling me that I just like spent all of this book getting to know Harper and then now I'm like not going to hear from her again. What? So kind of weird, but I'm very interested to like see how this story like continues and wraps up and how it takes all of these well-developed characters and finishes their story. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
One thing that is important about Harper, and that the book talks about pretty freely is that Harper has cerebral palsy.
Yes. Representation.
And it is not ignored. It is not the most important thing about her, but it is something that she lives with. It is part of her. But she goes out of her way to say multiple times, like, I'm not broken. Like, I'm just different. Like, no, it's not a limp. No, it's not an injury, you know, like, no, I'm not going to recover from this, but that also doesn't make me any less than anyone else. Like,
yeah,
I thought it was great.
I did too. And I thought, you know, the author's note is really brief, to the point. I think it's worth reading. So it says, much like a real world individual who has CP, Harper is not defined by the condition. Instead, it's something that is part of her daily life. I strove to create a girl who was strong, resilient, and capable, not in spite of any physical challenges she might face, but in addition to them. As Harper tells Ren, cerebral palsy affects everyone differently. Capabilities will vary from person to person, so her story is just that, a story. Harper's experience may not be reflective of all people with CP, but hopefully her determination and tenacity will be relatable to everyone. I encourage readers to learn more about cerebral palsy at www.cerebralpalsy.org.
Yeah, I just think that she sums it up really well. Like, it's not one of those, like, oh, she's strong because she overcame her disability stories, like, which, yeah, you made the right noise. but no, she's a strong person and she has cerebral palsy. Those two things exist.
Yeah. Like, they're not mutually exclusive.
And they're not causal one from another. Yep. Like,
yep. Yeah. I think determination and tenacity, like, that's a good way to describe Harper. Like, I think she developed that character well. And one of the things that I really appreciated about Harper's character development in the book is the way that this sort of new role that she takes on allows her to learn some new things. Like, she always knew that she was strong, resilient, capable, like, all of that. But she learns to, like, defend herself in new ways and learns new skills. And, you know, she kind of has this realization that her brother, Jake, treated her as this, like, breakable object, you know, who was more vulnerable than she was strong. And, you know, with learning things that are completely new, not just to her, but, like, to her whole way of life, like, you know, like, archery and wielding a dagger and stuff like that, you know, she's able to say, like, okay, like, I'm not as vulnerable as Jake treated me. And so it's really interesting when Jake comes to Emberfall at, you know, towards the end and is like, oh, Harper, like, you turned into this kind of, like, badass who can really stand up to yourself, like, for yourself, and cool.
Yeah, and he has some resentment about that. Like, that's not the role that he's used to playing with her. And
nope. He's used to being protector.
Which I thought was interesting. Yeah, I think Harper sort of discovering, because she does have some apprehension at the beginning. Like, okay, you expect me to pretend to be a princess? Are you kidding? And she realizes, like, no, like, she's good at leadership. Like, she just hasn't ever had the opportunity to explore that side of herself. And, like, but when given the responsibility and the opportunity, like, she really rises to the occasion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yes, we like Harper.
We do. And I...
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
One other thing about cerebral palsy that she talks about in the acknowledgments is that she has a friend who has CP. Yes. And she would text her and be like, hey, do you think if in the heat of battle, you could throw yourself off a horse and tackle somebody? And her friend texted back, yes, like, yes, I could. Like, yeah, which I just love.
It sounded like she and her friend, like, grew up, like, riding horses together and stuff too, which is cool. So, like, some of that sounds like comes from her own friendship.
But I just like that she was like heavily informed and in conversation with somebody yes. who lives with cerebral palsy to be able to say, like, you know, like, I didn't imagine this from whole cloth. Like, I, mm-hmm. like, this isn't, it does not feel like she's co-opting it for her own story.
No, this book is well-researched. I mean, she also had, like, a doctor friend so that she could, you know, parse out some of what Noah would and wouldn't be able to do.
How many stitches Gray would need, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. Also, I love Noah.
I love Noah too. He's great.
He truly is. Honestly, when he's like back in Emberfall and like takes over the infirmary, the, you know, the chick that was running before is like, yes, doctor. It's like, yes, Noah, that's right. Like, you own your space.
Noah is Jake's boyfriend, also from the real world. So, okay. So Harper, do we want to talk about who else do we want there? Okay. We could talk about Gray. We could talk about Ren. It sounds from what I just said, like it's a love triangle and it's kind of not.
Yeah. It like also kind of is, but it's not.
It sort of is and it sort of isn't.
It's mostly not, but like it's a little bit there. And then there's also Lilith who cannot be ignored.
She cannot.
So, yeah.
Let's talk about Lilith. Let's just go there. So, first of all, like, putting on my biblical scholar hat, this ongoing use of the word of the name Lilith to be an evil seductress character name really bugs me. And I know that it's fine. It's just a name, but like, it's a weird use of extra biblical sources, and it bugs me.
Yeah, let's. Can you parse that out for us a little bit, Jenny? What are extra biblical sources?
So there are Jewish traditions that arose, and sometimes concurrent to, and a lot of times after what we know as the Old Testament was written, and it's often commentary on it or sort of asking and answering questions about different biblical stories or laws or any other genre, really. And there is a tradition that Adam, the first man God creates in the Genesis story, that Adam has a first wife whose name is Lilith, who is not submissive to him, and who therefore, the stories differ, but therefore like gets cast out and becomes a demon. And then he's given Eve, who's, you know, a submissive, perfect wife, whatever, you know, there are layers of misogyny to peel back there. But, so
that's a different podcast.
That's a different podcast, but basically there's a long tradition of using Lilith as a name to demonize a woman who is not under male authority. And I don't think that's this Lilith's primary problem.
No.
But I read that her name was Lilith and I was like,
yeah. Also just like the evil enchantress thing, right? Like, I think it's an interesting way to play it because, you know, I have to say, I'm honestly not familiar with like the original Beauty and the Beast and like what role the Enchantress played there, but at least in the Disney movie, with which I'm very familiar, you know, the Enchantress curses them because of a lack of kindness and hospitality. This is not that.
No.
This is like a hardcore power play, which gets more complicated towards the end of the book and then into the second when we learn more about Lilith's people, the, you know, mages or whatever, mage smiths. And yeah, so like magic in this book is kind of like demonized in this, yeah, in this first installment, if you will.
Yeah, and Lilith, I don't know what to say about Lilith.
She's a piece of work.
Like, she's so, like, cartoonishly evil at some points. Like, she just, like, tortures Ren all the time because she can. And
yeah. I will say Lilith is a character that's, like, not really very developed.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't totally dive in to why she chooses to exact revenge in this, like, specific way, other than that she wants to rule Ren's kingdom. Like, she wants power.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't go, like, super deep into the whole, like, massacre of her people type thing, which I feel mm-hmm. like is an important aspect.
Mm-hmm. Like, I would agree.
You know, okay, like, we're afraid, and so we're going to kill all of these people. And the remnant comes for revenge.
Well, and it's weird, right? Because that's her larger motivation. But, like, and this might be a character thing more than an author thing, but the characters seem to view her as, like, she's just a malicious, awful person, and she's a woman, and she be doing these things. Like, I got the vibe a lot that it was like, oh, isn't she such an evil woman? It's like, well, yeah, she is, but, like, it's a little weird.
What a seductress. And mm-hmm. I mean, like, she does. She seduces Ren.
That's how it starts.
Right? It's, like, after she, like, fails to seduce his father, essentially.
Ugh.
Right, which is gross. But, yeah, that's another aspect of this, is that Ren's father also seems like a piece of work.
Yeah, I mean, this book is interesting. I don't know when I want to bring this up, so I'll just do it now. There is this ongoing thread through the book of, like, so the moment in the book where I was like, oh, this is great. Harper is understandably really mad, and Ren wants to calm her down, and Gray is like, well, just, like, hang out with her. And he's like, I can't, like, he's so, like, self-important in these ways, and, like, he can't just, like, sit down with somebody. And Gray just starts playing cards with her,
mm-hmm.
Which is, like, the moment where I was like, oh, Gray,
you're great. I want to, like, learn and play that card game. It sounded fun.
But they're playing cards, and obviously this develops into a more nuanced conversation than just playing cards. But Ren and Harper have this conversation, and Ren says, my father once said we are all dealt a hand at birth. A good hand can ultimately lose, just as a poor hand can win. But we must all play the cards fate deals. The choices we face may not be the choices we want, but they are choices nonetheless. And then at the very end, let me maneuver in my Kindle real fast. At the very end, Harper says, she, you know, talks about what his father says. And then she says, I don't think he's right. I think you get cards and you play them, but then you get more cards. I don't think it's all predestined from the beginning. All along the way, you could have made a different choice, and this all could have ended up differently. Failure isn't absolute. Just because you couldn't save everyone doesn't mean you didn't save anyone.
Mm.
And I think that's so interesting. Like, this idea that everyone makes choices with the information that they have at the time. And that means that we make imperfect choices, and yeah, we have regrets. And I think that's a pretty nuanced way of looking at characters and people, to say that, you know, we do what we can with what we have. And that means we make mistakes, and that means that people get hurt, and that doesn't make you a bad person. It just makes you a human, you know, and how I just think that's important. I think that's an interesting way to view the book.
Yeah.
And I think applying that to Lilith is interesting. Like, you know, at what point did she make the, how, you know, what the path she sets out on, like, as somebody whose people were massacred and she wants revenge, like, that makes sense. But then with what the more information she gets and the more choices and the more power she gets, she makes, you know, continuing choices, like the choices build on choices. And then she ends up in this really, I don't like the term evil to be thrown around that often, but she ends up in this pretty evil place. She tortures a lot of people, or Ren specifically. And yeah, so I don't know. I just think what this book how this book talks about agency is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially, okay, yeah. So speaking of agency, I want to talk about Ren. And mm-hmm. I want to talk about his beast form. Mm-hmm. And like whether or not he has agency as a beast.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Yeah, because, right, like, I mean, he kills his whole family. Mm-hmm. I mean, he kills essentially everyone but Gray, including some of the women that they bring mm-hmm. to try to break the curse. And then Harper comes, and there's, like, I don't know, like, something special about Harper, perhaps, that makes her able to sort of, like, reach him in that place. I don't know. I'm very interested in the way that, like, Lilith's torture and curse, you know, of how that affects Ren and how his trauma informs his choices and, like, how that then informs how the story moves forward. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my highlights is just, I think it's chapter 40, monster, blank page.
Destroy. You know?
Well, one of them is destroy, but one of them is just a blank page.
Oh, yes. That's true.
And
I just read the destroy page, like, before we got on this podcast.
That one's later. And yeah, I think monster transformation as connected to trauma is this really interesting thing. Like, I don't know. I would say the way I read it was that, not that there's something particularly special about Harper, but just as time progressed, he's dealt with, like, through his relationship with her, he's been able to process more about about who he is and how he can respond to becoming this monster. Mm. Which, you know, might be kind of a wrong reading, but I think that it's less that there's something special about Harper and more that it's a mark that he's grown in this season that he's had with her. Not necessarily like, you know, the right woman changed him or whatever, but just that, like, he finally learned, like, through yeah. Gray and through Harper and through Freya and, you know, Jameson and all the people, that it was the season that changed him.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good reading of it. I also want to talk a little bit, but give a bit of a content warning. He attempts to kill himself mm-hmm. quite a few times. But the time where it makes, like, a pretty big impact is when he tries to jump from the ramparts and transforms in midair into something with wings. Mm-hmm. It says Ren tried to sacrifice himself to protect his people. Even in his last effort to beat Lilith at something, he failed. And right, like, that's why Gray doesn't come back for Harper, at least initially. And yeah, I mean, that was hard for me to read.
Yeah.
The idea that, I mean, right, like, the whole idea that self-sacrifice is noble is a very interesting and somewhat problematic thing to talk about. All right, again, like putting on my like theology cap here. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that's talked about in atonement theology, mm-hmm. is, you know, like God sacrificing God's only child for the forgiveness of the sins of God's people. And different people have different theologies and ways of thinking about that. But some of the stuff that we read in seminary criticized the idea of seeing the sacrifice of Jesus as something to sort of amplify, like, you know, the whole take up your cross narrative because of the way mm-hmm. that it's been used against oppressed people. Mm-hmm. But
well, and with the recognition that Jesus was executed by the state.
Yes,
100%. Like that his suffering wasn't self-inflicted. Yeah, it was taken on. It wasn't taken on. It was forced upon.
Right. Which is like an interesting concept because we're talking about God here.
Sure.
You know, like we're talking about what we believe in and call the Trinity, God, Creator, Christ, and Holy Spirit. And so, you know, if you think about God as all powerful and all knowing, like, didn't Christ take it on, or did he, you know, like these are the kind of questions. It gets messy. And these are the kind of things that, that theologians think about and talk about. And so, you know, like to go back to the book, to Ren, Ren is not an oppressed person. He is a tortured person who has endured a lot of trauma. But he has a position of power. You know, how that power can and cannot be used is kind of debatable and gets really sticky towards the end as, you know, rumors of, you know, well, not just rumors, but like uprisings from surrounding cities and things like that take place. But yeah, I don't know, just the whole idea of like, you know, Ren tried to make this noble sacrifice thing is just, I don't know. It's so complicated. And yeah, it was hard for me to read.
Thanks for sharing that, Shelbs. Yeah, I don't know. I grew to like Ren, but I very much grew to like Gray.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. I still have Gray a lot of just mixed feelings about Ren. Gray, I like him, but yeah, Gray.
Gray has this. He has this continued like quiet nobility, and not. I don't mean that in like the royalty sense, but in the like self-assured, I'm going to use the word gallant. It's not quite the right word. He seems to be somebody who carries himself with a lot of dignity and, thinks about things really seriously and, you know, doesn't always make the best choices. And once again, he kidnaps a woman for Ren. But I don't know. I like Gray a lot. I'm excited that the next book is more about him.
Yeah, it gets really, really interesting. And so, okay, let's talk a little bit more about Gray, particularly towards the end. There is at first this question of what happens to Gray, and that question is answered, but not in a neat, like tied in a bow kind of way, right? Because of course not, because there's a sequel and then another sequel. But yeah.
Say more.
So Gray also sort of does this like sacrifice type thing at the end, right? And it's mm-hmm. different than Ren's. But in order to get Lilith away from the people that he cares about, Ren and Harper, he sort of, you know, makes this like, I'll serve you kind of deal, rather than allowing Lilith to continue to manipulate and hurt the people that he cares about. Mm-hmm. And so he takes her with the power that she gave him to go to DC. He takes her to DC and slits her throat. Because she can't die in their world. But the idea is that he can kill her in DC.
Right. Yeah.
But then, and so it's like, okay, well, you know, once he's killed her, he'll come back.
And then he doesn't come back.
And then he doesn't come back. And so there's, yeah, the question of like, what happens to Gray? And Harper and Ren have like really both grown to care about him. And he doesn't come back. And then you get to the epilogue.
Mm-hmm.
From Gray's perspective, which is the first. Is this the first from Gray's perspective?
Yes. The epilogue is the first time we hear from his perspective.
That's what I thought. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, she taunts him with some supposed truth about Ren, about himself, about the true heir, about the blood that runs in his veins.
So I have not started the second book. So my presumption is that Lilith somehow knows that Gray is like secretly the true heir to Emberfall's throne, which is very interesting. But
yeah,
we're gonna find out more about that, I suppose, in the second book.
And that Lilith is like in cahoots with the ruler of their, you know, upstairs neighbor who is mm-hmm. at war with them, like trying to conquer their kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, but so yeah, like the twist, right, is that like Gray doesn't come back to Iron Rose, but he does come back to Emberfall.
Mm-hmm.
He goes back to where he grew up.
Yeah.
With his, with the woman who raised him up to a point, right? Until mm-hmm. he went to the Royal Guard. Who he's questioning if she's really his mother and all of that. And then he leaves her too. And sort of shirks his identity as Gray, the Royal Guardsman, and that's the end.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I mean, I think Gray. I think it's really interesting, and there's a moment. So the reason that I said like Harper has to fall in love with him to break the curse, like that's what everyone presumes, but towards the very end, there's this moment of like, okay, does true love have to be romantic? Like, could it be like acts, like an act of like devotion? And like, if that's the case, like no one has devoted themselves more to Ren than Gray has.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this question at the end of like, okay, is it because Harper loves him or is it because Gray showed this ultimate act of love by like putting his own needs and wants on the line to take care of Lilith, like, which I think is a really interesting question. And I think this book, I was just having a conversation with my sister-in-law, hi Katie, about about how there's not enough male friendship in fiction. Men are either like put completely at odds with one another, or they fall in love, like they're, but there's not, or they're like battle brothers, right? But there's not just a lot of like, we're just like, we just have a really strong friendship. Like, you just don't see that very often.
Yeah.
And I think Ren and Gray get there towards the end of, like, you know, there's that moment where Gray, who has like pretty much never drank in his life, like everything has gone completely batty, and you know, Ren's like, all right, it's time, we're drinking together. And there's this real moment of vulnerability between them, and I think the idea that like it could have been the true love of friends that saves Ren, I think that's a really beautiful idea.
It is. And if you will allow me, Jenny and dear listener, to mention Frozen for a second episode in a row.
I was waiting for it.
Yeah. You know, like, it's kind of like the end of Frozen. Spoiler alert for Frozen. If you haven't seen it, it's worth a watch, in my opinion. Although
I don't secretly hate Frozen, so you're good.
I'm okay. Yeah, that might have been a friendship ender. No, I'm just kidding. my sister doesn't even really like animated movies, so, you know, like, it's okay. But yeah, at the end of Frozen, you know, it's thought that what will heal Anna's frozen heart is like a true love's kiss or whatever, but it's actually her own act of selflessness, her own act of love for her sister, that saves her. And it's that same kind of idea, right? That like, it doesn't always have to be that romantic love. And I love it when that idea is played with.
Mm-hmm.
It's also kind of like, Maleficent, right?
I haven't seen that movie.
Oh, okay. Worth a watch. Okay. I mean, it's kind of silly, but like in a good way. I don't know.
Okay.
It's sweet. It's a sweet movie. But yeah. Yeah. I love it. I love it when those relationships, when other relationships and the love and devotion, are highlighted in a way that doesn't have to be romantic.
I agree. Well, Shelby, we've been at this for about an hour. Do you want to talk about ratings?
Yeah, let's.
You go first this week.
Okay. So I'm going to say I enjoyed this book. Having already read the second one, I like totally can't wait to tackle it. I think that we should do another episode.
Okay.
Spoiler alert again. Well, it's not really a spoiler alert. I'm not giving anything away about the second book, but I did like the second book actually better than this one.
Ooh.
So yeah, but for A Curse So Dark and Lonely, I'm going to give it, I think probably like a 7.75, maybe rounded up to 8.
All right. I was going to sit right at 8.
Do it.
8 out of 10. 8 out of 10. Solid B. Yeah, I think there's a lot to like about this book. I think the characters are really well-rounded. I think the themes are interesting. So, yeah, I definitely a solid read. Thanks for picking it out.
Yeah, I mean, when you hear about a fairy tale retelling where the main character has cerebral palsy, like, I was just like, yeah, like, we totally have to read this on the pod.
Mm-hmm. Sign us up. So, yeah, highly recommended to this one. It's a good time, and it sounds like the sequel is even more of a good time. So,
well, that's in my opinion. We're all waiting with bated breath to see what Jenny Snyder thinks.
To see if this is a Bridge to Terabithia situation.
I don't think it is. You're going to get a lot of great content.
That's good
to
know.
And we're going
to
introduce some new characters who are quite lovable.
Mm. On that same note, like, shout out to Freya and the kids for being amazing and lovely. Yes. And I love them.
And Zoe. Truly.
So many good side characters. Jameson.
Oh, yes.
Love to them all. Love to all of their fictional souls. Shelby, do we want to tell the people where to find us?
Yeah. So we can be found on Instagram at Trebra Book Club, as well as through our website, TrebraBookClub.com, and our email, TrebraBookClub@gmail.com.
You can also leave us a voice message on Anchor. We would absolutely love to hear what you think about this book or about any future books that you think we should cover. And we might even include you on a future episode.
Yeah. And, you know, okay. So something I've been thinking about is like, maybe we should kind of say in advance what books we're going to be covering so that we can, like, if people actually leave us voice messages, we can cover them on the episode where we're covering that book.
I'm nodding at you, but you can't see me.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of books that we are going to be reading coming up. First of all, the sequel to A Curse So Dark and Lonely, which is A Heart So Fierce and Broken. Mm-hmm. That's not going to be one that we cover immediately, but we should do it. So another sequel to a more recent episode. Jenny, you're already reading this one.
Yeah, I am. Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi, the sequel to Children of Blood and Bone. I was 26 pages into my library copy when I realized I wanted to highlight everything so badly that I just went and bought the Kindle book. So I'm not terribly far in, but as far as I am, I'm already very interested. So,
yeah. And then
lastly,
We mentioned this in our last episode where we talked about All the Stars and Teeth, but Jenny has read it and I have not yet. So one that I'm going to be reading soon is called House of Salt and Sorrows
by Aaron Craig. Yeah, I gave it a read while I was off from work and it's an interesting one. So I want to talk about it.
Yes. And I also love the dynamic that you've read the book before I have.
I know, so. For once.
Yeah, because Jenny's time off work as a teacher is very different from my time off work as a pastor. She actually gets a Christmas break, so.
It's true.
So yeah, I'll catch up during my vacation in January.
Well, Shelby, your body is good.
Your body is good, Jenny. All bodies are good bodies.
Listener, your body is good exactly the way it is.
Amen.
Amen.
We've been trying to figure out how to end episodes, and maybe that's it.
I think it might be amen.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. I apologize for the delay in editing and releasing episodes. Unfortunately, our day jobs have gotten pretty busy. So in the meantime, we invite you to get in touch. Let us know what book you want us to cover next.